Welcome. My name is Jeremy Hunt. I'm the chairman of Veterans on Duty. And today we are back with another episode of Beyond the Call. And of course, Beyond the Call is our series where we dive into conversations with different leaders around our nation who are veterans, who have served, and most importantly, who care deeply about veterans and care deeply about issues and national security issues in particular. Today, we are at the Department of Veterans Affairs for a very special episode. I'm going to be interviewing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Doug Collins, a good friend of mine and just an amazing man. And we're going to be talking about his efforts here at Veterans Affairs, even some interesting stories just from his background, personal stories of his. Let's dive in. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Secretary, for making the time for us. We've been really looking forward to the sitting down with you, talking about the issues that both of us care so much about. And here at Veterans on Duty, we're a policy advocacy organization, mostly focused on national security issues, but we're all made up of veterans who care deeply about our country. And so having someone like you, who is just such an incredible leader, and also just a personal friend to me, us both being from the great state of Georgia, and I guess we should start there, starting in your kind of early days. You were born and raised in Gainesville, is that right? I would love to hear just your upbringing and how that shaped you and made you want to serve our country.
Well, it really started everything, and it's good to be with you. And my dad, mom and dad, I had a great, mom and dad. My mom's passed now. My dad's still with me. He's still there. He's 87, 88 now, so he's getting there. But he's a 31-year state trooper. So I grew up in a trooper's home. As I like to say, I fought the law won every time. He's 6'2", 250-pound. I mean, just a prototype Georgia patrolman, blue and gray. And, growing up, we didn't have anything, so to speak. But, mom and dad provided for my brother and I. And, because dad worked the great deal, we didn't take long trips. We wasn't in the others, but we never lacked for anything. So it was always a great childhood. I mean, I actually live now very close to where I grew up. Still go by the same, woods and how we used to get put out in the yard. Moms, I'd go out and come back later, and we would. And, it was just one of those childhoods where with dad working, it was one of the things for me was I had two sort of things in life that I did know being outside is I learned to love to read and I love music. And that took me away from that little peninsula in Gainesville and Lake Lanier to all over the world. So now that I've been blessed enough is in life, I've been just amazed to be able to go around the world, little in the military, but also in work. It's amazing what those memories of learning back then and just sort of absorbing it brought back to me. And my mom and dad always supported that and pushed it.
Yeah, that's amazing. And one thing I wanted to talk about, too, is your decision to join the military and raise your right hand and decide to serve. And so I understand that you joined in the 90s and for a couple of years then you were chaplain. Yeah. But what's so interesting is that even after 9/11, mm-hmm. you decided to go back in and join during a time of war. You talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I missed it. I was in the early 90s. I just started as my sort of path is like a good North Georgia, back road, sort of curvy and twisty in the mountains up there. A lot of different ways thinking I was going to start one place and God, I think, ended up being another. And I had just, in my mind, had answered a call to ministry and I was in seminary. And this idea that I didn't know really existed was a chaplaincy. And it was something I said I'd always wanted to be a part. Even I went to University of North Georgia, old North Georgia College back then. And it's interesting, I've been in the military basically most of my adult life, but I was a commuter puke in college. I mean, I lived close enough and I had to work through college. So I had to go work. So I would work at a grocery store back home and did that for 5 years. And so I drove back and forth. So even on this military campus, I enjoyed it. It was something I'd been a part of, so I've been looking at it. So when the opportunity came available, they had a program in the Navy, a chaplain candidate program. That's when I got in. Spent some time, more of my time actually with the Marines than I did with the Navy because, of course, the Navy chaplains do all three. They do Coast Guard and the Marines as well. So it was just an experience. But at that time, my wife and I had a young daughter at the time. She has spinal bifida. She's now 33. She is. She still lives with us. But she had a lot of, complications early on. And so it was hard to keep up. And they wanted me to go to active duty. And at that point in time, the church that I had just went to was taking a lot of time. It was starting to grow. Then Jordan's physical needs and with that. And then I just didn't feel led at the time to go to active duty. So I got out, regrettably got out for a while. And then that sort of pain of enjoying, you know, being in the military and being in that environment was coming back in 01, even before, right before 9/11, but then afterwards it was just accelerated. And I, by then we had all three of our kids. Lisa was teaching school, and we prayed about it and agreed, and I went back in. Air Force was willing to give me an opportunity in the reserve. And so we took it, and that's where I've been so far. So it's really interesting going to MEPS I've been 30 some, you know, in my early 30s when I went back in. It was like, wow, this is sitting there with 18-year-olds who just went to the prom the night before kind of thing. It's like, and what are you here for? Well, I'm here to chaperone you. No, it's like, whatever. But it was good. But back in, I've been in now 24, almost 25 plus years. Deployed. It's been a great experience.
And you're still in that, and you're still in your colonel in the
Air Force.
Wow. How was that balancing being in the National Guard in the reserves, rather, as a colonel, and also balancing as Secretary of Veterans Affairs?
Very difficult.
I'm also close enough to retirement, so that's in fact, I was just discussing that with him because I'm having to get points not in a regular basis because being in my position, it's probably good. I don't have a billet that I could have. I could. Probably force it if I wanted to, but we're in a key position. If something went down, I'm here. So, I mean, it's not an option back and forth. So I'm in IR now for this last year, but I do points only, and I got to get to March 1st and get that one last good year to retire colonel, and my wife is going to make sure that happens. And coming back in, it's been interesting for me because I went from, you know, butter bar to, you know, colonel. If you'd have told me back then I'd ever made it to a bird, it was like, I never would. And I actually ended up making it. So
that's really cool. Well, I do want to go back to some of the early time in the military because you deployed to Iraq in 2008,
yes.
one of the most violent parts of the war, one of the most kind of tumultuous times there. Can you take us back there? Were there any experiences that you had there that really shaped your view on the importance of serving veterans and serving our military?
Yeah, for me, I was a nighttime flatline chaplain, which I absolutely, I think I pull the best assignment there. I think the active duty chaplain, there's always been this tug between active and reserve as if there's a difference, so to speak. Active sort of looking, you know, and I'll just be honest here. I mean, we're all military folks. You're a reservist. And I remember coming into Balad to the chaplain and he said, oh, you're a reservist. Well, I was also older than most of the chaplains already. I'd already had more. I had 11 years senior pastor experience. I mean, had been doing this forever. So I said, yeah. And so I was captain, you know, pretty well young captain at the time. And so they said, we're going to put you on nighttime flight line. And I said, okay. So I took it, loved it. I got to go everywhere. I was the only chaplain on duty out on the flight line. So I went into TOC. I went into security force. I went everywhere. I went to the secret squirrel camp, you know, place over there. And it was just great. But one night a week, I had to relieve the night chaplain at the hospital at Balad. And Balad was, at that time, we were coming down, if you remember the time frame, you're right, we were still, I mean, it's Mortaritaville for a reason. I mean, it was, you know, two or three times a day we were getting still shelled. But it was also the main central collection hospital for especially northern Iraq, in particular Baghdad, all the rest. And so we were still seeing a lot of IED issues. We're seeing a lot of others coming in. So for me, dealing with that once a week just showed the importance of our medical, what we had going on, and also that long term. And then it really made an impactful part on me to see what we were doing to get people through the Heroes Highway. If you go back and look into pictures of Balad, if you ever Google Balad and come up Heroes Highway, you see that flag that was underneath, it was over an awning where the choppers would come in and they would bring them through. If they brought a person through alive under that flag, there was a 98% chance we got them out of Iraq, at least back to Germany or back to the U.S. alive. 98%. This was catastrophic injury, sometimes others. But it just reminded me that there's a, you know, the different parts of this. So as a chaplain, you always deal, and there's times in Iraq that I would deal with the normal problems, you know, family hogs back home. I don't like this. You know, my commander hates me, that kind of stuff. Or my wife's leaving me. You know, that was a terrible issues you have to deal with. But the hospital took it a different step. And for me now, coming full circle to be the secretary of the VA, which I have 172 hospitals and 1,200 CBOCs and, you know, 390,000 medical people that work in these hospitals, it reminded me of the need of individuals care. And there was one story in particular. If you remember back at the time, Stars and Stripes would all in their weekly paper out in the right, they would actually put the pictures of those deceased, if they had them, on the about page 5 or 6 there. And I remember picking it up one night when I went to the DFAC to eat. And there was about 4 or 5 on there that I had personally seen or prayed over or talked about. Mm-hmm. And so that put it really real for me, that. But just the what we do now. So I see those coming back. Some of those probably I saw in Balada are now in our system. And, you know, if they are in Balada, you were there between 08 and 09, send me a note. I'd love to talk to you.
That's awesome. And you have a couple items, too, just from your time in service. I'd love to hear, you know, the meaning behind all that. You got blood patch right here in front of us.
Yeah, the blood patch. It was one we had out there. And actually, it was interesting. I've got several blood patches. This one actually came from someone here. I had seen this patch. I almost bought this patch. And I think I actually gave it away, to be honest. But they brought it. It's called Margaritaville. Blood was known as Margaritaville, especially early on. It was the old Iraqi Air Force Academy, if you would. It was where Saddam and the sons would, that's where they trained their Air Force, what little they had. And so it was there. I really like it because it also incorporates the 332nd, which was the air wing. That is the old, for those who knew military history, 332nd is the Tuskegee Airmen. Yes. Red Tails. So we were the Red Tails. That was activated for that wing as we go forward. So that was just something that reminds me of it. And the Margaritaville just reminds us that every day we were getting pounded. The bracelet was given to me one night by a young lady who I would always go around and see a lot of security forces at the gates and stuff. And I would have, in the middle of the night, I'd have the rippets and little small rippets, which, by the way, you can't find in the United States. They were like this great. They were, you know, 6 ounces, 7 ounces, 8 ounces. And they would always say, man, I'd always give them something. And we'd talk. And one night I came by and she said, you're always giving us something. I want to give you something just so you remember. And she gave me that. And I wore it the whole rest of the time I was in Iraq, and I've worn it many times since just to remind me of who we serve. Yeah. I used it in the dog tags when I was in my confirmation hearing to always remind me of what this place is really about. And it's about taking care of people. It's about taking care of the ones who raise that right hand, who commit to service and go at it. And I use those in my confirmation hearing to say every day, this is what I'm going to remember. So it wasn't a surprise that my first day here in February, I said, there's a new mantra at the VA, and it is that veterans are first at the VA. The only reason we exist is a veteran. We're not about ourselves. And we had gotten sort of, as any large organization would do, we sort of had gotten pretty bureaucratic and internal focus. And those remind me every day that it's about a veteran. If the veteran stops showing up, we don't have a job. So everything we're supposed to do.
That's amazing. And so getting back from Iraq, you go back home to Georgia, and you decided to take off the uniform and continue serving in public service and running for office. First running for State House, and then for State, and then for Congress. So what was that decision process like?
Well, it was sort of interesting. I got to take a step back. Actually, a couple of years before, I left the church and went to law school. And in my first year of law school, I actually got State House seat where I lived came open. And this was in 07, 06, 07 election, and I was elected, took my seat in 07. And so I was going to law school and serving in the Georgia General Assembly at the same time, full-time, still coaching football at night for my boys and riding the bus in the morning down to Atlanta. And so it was really interesting to see that. And actually, when I deployed, I was elected to my second term while I was deployed. In Iraq. And also, you talk about an interesting year. 08 was a pretty fascinating year for me. Graduated law school in May, took the bar in July, deployed to Iraq in August, found out I passed the bar on Halloween in the desert. My wife calling, we're crying over the phone that I passed the bar. I came home in January, got sworn back. And this is, I think, for veterans, if you're listening to this and you're still serving, you're still doing deployments, take your time off when you get back. I didn't. I got to go back in. I got to get started. I got a law practice now. I got to do it. And my wife and I were just talking about this the other day. I had talked about this on another podcast. I never stopped. And I think, you know, detrimentally to myself, whether in ways that maybe I don't know, I didn't have time to process. And I noticed later on that it would be more events that would say, wow, that it would be emotional. Someone would bell up and it just like, you know, and, but it was, I think, so I just encourage our veterans, take, you know, those active duty service right now, take your time to do transition well, because it is so important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so you're in office, and then after, and of course, you stayed in close touch with President Trump.
Oh, yeah. They got elected to Congress in 12 and then.
Well, yeah. So, and now Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Can you just take us, what is like the day in the life of the Secretary of Veterans Affairs? And what does that look like for you, for people watching at home? But, you know, VA can kind of be like a black box, like in your life. Yeah. And so I'm curious to see what that's been like for you.
Well, that's one of the reasons I do all these podcasts. I do as much. I want us to be as transparent as ever. I sort of got that, you know, public service from, like, as we talked earlier about my dad. And, you know, you're just out there and you do the work and you deal with. But a day, an average day, well, it's a day's kind of an average day. I started at 5. I've done 4. I did 4 TV hits before 8:30 on 4 different networks. And then we came into meetings. I've had, you know, meetings of from department. When you run an organization of 450,000 people, it's a lot. And so you're getting updated with the folks that you trust and you put in those places to keep you going. I'm a very hands-on. I think most of my staff would laugh a little bit that hands-on. I'm very involved. I'm not one that sits behind a desk in company. I'll walk around. If you're in this building and I show up in your office, don't be surprised, because if I want to know something, I just go and find out. So you do meetings all through the day, you know, other podcasts and stuff. And then I'll typically, if it's a good day, I'm out of here by 5, you know, 12-hour days, you know, 5:30. And then, if I get to, go home, or if not, like last night I had to do some events for the, embassy, the German embassy. We had an event with veterans from there. They had their first Veterans Day this past June, for the United Germany. So, just stuff like that, it goes on. So it's a lot of meetings, a lot of interaction, but I enjoy it as opposed, I really enjoy my time in Congress, really enjoy my time at state legislature in Georgia, but there's a difference. In Congress, I had to go find 219 votes. I had to go find 218. I had to find an extra vote, 219, to pass anything. Here, I divide it up into, is it statute, policy, or procedure, or regulation? Mm-hmm. If it's the two P's or the R, I can change those. And we can make real difference. And that's what we've really done here in the last 9 months, is to go into our hospitals, go into our accountability areas and disability stuff, and make real change. And I'm not here for the next job. I'm not here for where this goes next. I'm here for 4 years. My wife and I are in a little condo having, you know, we're back honeymooning it again. My beautiful little bride's 30. We've been married 37 years. And we've probably grown closer together in those last 9 months in a way that I would have never expected. We're already close. For anybody who knows us, we're extremely close.
Everybody in Georgia knows is the relationship with your wife is something that's really beautiful.
It is. And so we're up here having fun. So, she gets to travel a little bit with me. And when she gets to travel, she can relate to some of the family members and stuff too. So it's really good. That's what a day in life is like. It's never the same. It's never, I also have to say there's never a day when if I don't get an email or I get somebody walk in my office and I say, what the heck? How did this happen?
Never a dull moment, I had. Well, I do want to talk about some of the priorities that you put in place here. One thing that I've heard you talk a lot about is modernizing tech and using a lot of these emerging technologies to make sure that we can be more efficient here at VA. And one thing that came up even in our confirmation hearing was about the electronic health record system, modernizing that to make it more efficient for veterans. Can you talk to us a little bit about where that stands right now? I saw this in the project.
Yeah, it was a huge issue. And this started actually when I was in Congress. Most hospital systems and doctor's offices now, over the past 15, 20 years, have went to an electronic health record system in which they input stuff, you get out, and you can, you know, now with some of the systems, including ours, you can go to an app on your phone, you can make appointments, you can do it. We still use a really outdated system in the VA as a VISTA system. We spend $700 million a year just to keep it up on life support. And that's just how it is. So a number of years ago, about 8, the Congress said, okay, we agree, let's do a system. It went out on bid. It caught resistance. I'm being kind here. And it didn't work out well with the first six sites. Didn't work well because the VA allowed every hospital to make them individual tweaks. So they didn't even talk to each other. It was slowed down. And so after that was a disaster, they just sort of stopped. Now, all along, we're spending billions of dollars on this program. And so we've wasted $12, $13 billion to get a program that didn't work. So we came in and said, look, we're gonna see where we're at. We're going to bring all the players in, make an assessment, and fix it as best we can. Or I'm going to go back to Congress and say, it's too far gone.
Yeah.
What we found was a broken system that could be fixed. So what we did is there was going to be four. The previous secretary, he had said that we'll do four next year, 26. After we got in and we made some standardization issues and some others, we found we could do 13 next year, so 13 more sites. And then it's going to snowball into the 2030, 2031 time frame with 25, 30 more a year for 172 plus the C-box as we go. So it's very good. But all along, we're not waiting for that to come. We're going to be adding ambient monitoring, our ambient scribe, which is you go to most of your – in fact, I was with my dad at a doctor's appointment. I was able to go with him a few weeks ago, and his doctor is on the phone, and it records the conversation in the room. So the doctor doesn't miss anything, and it just quickly works through the paperwork. We're going to have that hopefully. They told us – I love how this works, government. They came and told us a few months ago, oh, that'd take 2 years to fix. I put some of my best guys on it. Within 2 months, we had picked out what the system was going. We now have a trial going out this month. We figure by the end of the year, it'll be, before the end of the year, it'll be done. And by spring of next year, it'll be in all of our hospitals. So that's the kind of things that we're doing to say, we're not waiting on a system. We're going to use the technology that's around us.
That's great. And, another issue that we hear a lot about from veterans is, the claims backlog. And I mean, I remember when I was here, I was a cadet intern here in 2013. And I remember it was a big issue then. I was in the Office of Interagency Collaboration, and we were talking about all this stuff. And I remember this was an issue then, and it just has continued to be an issue through all these years. So can you bring us up to speed with where it stands right now and what you're doing, in your position to expedite those claims?
Well, again, it goes back to my first statement that the VA is about the veteran, period. So you look at it from that perspective, the lens is, if it's about the veteran, how do we do it? We give fast, efficient, simple claims. If they have a disability claim and they can get their process in, we're going to make it easy. So that my personal goal is that they never have to go to any outside organization or attorney or anybody to fill out the basic forms. It should be easy enough. If they raise their right hand, they should be able to fill it out so they can get their benefit. We look at from healthcare. Is it easy to get in the healthcare system, or can they get what they need? We're breaking it out. Disability claims, for a number of reasons, had risen greatly under the previous administration. It got down very low under the President Trump's first term. But it had spiraled up due to a couple of things. And I say this in honesty. I don't like to just, throw out things and say, no, there wasn't a reason. COVID couldn't do the in-person exam some. And you had PACT Act, which came in a little bit more, which added some more claims to it. So the backlog of over 125 days on the day I swore in was 264,000. Okay, it was huge compared to late 1990, right before the 2019, before the COVID, it was in the 60-70 range. Okay, so we said, look, why does this matter? Number one, our veterans are upset because they can't get their claims; they don't know which way to go. So we said, let's go and put money and some time. We did overtime. We said, what gets measured gets done, and we said we're going to bring this down. Now, also something I don't talk about as much is that there was over 1 million in-process claims total. So you had 260,000 that were over 125 days, but we had over 1 million in the system. I said, we got to fix this. So we started that process in a little over 4.5 months. I can sit here today because we closed out the year on September 30th. We ended the year, and we are now at 134,000 in that backlog. We did right at 50%. In just a matter of 4.5 months. I mean, 50%. We took it from 264 to 134,000. Wow. And we did it. And now but the part that I like, and I don't always get a chance to talk about it, is that over 1 million is now at 600,000. So we're not just focused on what was behind, but we're keeping up to date on those coming in. So we're seeing that number shrink as well. It's all about a veteran. It's all about what that veteran would need. And so disability claims, and we got more ideas coming up. We're going to be looking at, you talked about technologies earlier. We're going to be use technology to go through medical records so that when they first come in for a disability rating, you know, there's a lot of these called CMP exams where they go out and say, well, let's see, you know, they make sure you have the injury and it came from a service-related condition. Right. Well, most of that was in people's records. So why don't we just use technology to scan the record? And if we see that, then, you know, we'll skip that exam. Paul Lawrence, who's my deputy, who was head of the VBA part of it in the previous administration, Trump administration, we started talking about if we can get that down, working with our, you know, hands-on people looking at it with the AI, we could save well over $1 billion to $2 billion a year by not having to use those CMP exams and getting people the stuff they need quicker.
Bill, when I was getting out, it was the same thing. I mean, it was, you know, I had to get these other exams done, all these things, even though it was in the record. And so that is amazing to see, just with some really common sense, you know, policy.
Yeah, exactly. We try to use common sense, which is not common in government. It's just not. Even in the military, it's not common sometimes.
That's right. And, you know, one thing that we see a lot of, you know, people like to talk about Veterans Affairs is, there's so much wastefulness and that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about what you've done to make it more efficient and cut out some of the fat, some of the things that are unnecessary?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's really important for us. One of the things that we had found is in 10 years, if you were 2015, just after you were here to 2025, I always said, and I made this comment early on, I said, and I had a large group of our senior officials, and I said, if I'd have came back in time, you were all sitting around this table, and I told you in 2015, the budget for the VA would look like this, and the personnel would look like this, you would have all pitched a party and thought that we were going to become the next Mayo Clinic. I mean, everything was going to be perfect because all of this money and all these people. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sitting here telling you, we now have all this money and all these people, and our metrics are going the wrong way. In fact, our wait times which, by the way, and I need to just encourage your listeners on this, we're the only organization that ever measures wait times in our healthcare system. So somebody says, well, I'm having to wait 3 weeks. Well, okay, ask your neighbor down the street how long they're waiting for. And I don't mean to compare. We're trying to get them in as fast as possible. But the reason we do wait times is when you were here 2013, 2014, we had the scandals in Augusta and Phoenix and in Atlanta where they were putting people on wait lists and never getting to them. We had people dying, okay? Colonoscopies not being done. So I don't fault, and I was in Congress at the time, we don't fault. That's the only way we knew. How could we get, you know, what gets measured gets done? Well, that was the only measurable, tangible way we could make sure that they were moving people through. But it's not the best way to do it. There's better ways to do it, like, you know, quality of care, those kind of things that you do metrics on, satisfaction rate, which is what every hospital in the world does except us. So I want to get us on this back to that same metrics as we go forward. So for me, it's just cutting out the time. Now, I've already told you about the disability claims. I've already told you the backlog is down. I've already told you that our wait times at our hospitals and clinics are getting better. What we looked at was in our personnel, in which we added over 100,000 employees in 10 years, and we added over $100 billion to our budget, over $100 billion. Now, think about that for a minute. And we're getting the wrong results. So people, obviously money and people were not the issue. Right. So we said, look, are we organized in the proper way? And that's what we're doing now. So we offered the early retirement program. You know, there was a lot of talking, and some agencies did a RIF in which they reduction force. They took, you know, different agents, and they said, we don't need this. We're not going to do this function. We're getting rid of. We were looking at that, but we did it from a perspective, if you want to take early retirement, you can do that, and you'll be out September, end of September, or the first, end of December. It's the two programs. We ended up with 30,000 people taking that, while we, at the same time, took 350,000-plus positions and exempted them. In other words, they couldn't take it. So our hospitals, our doctors, our nurses, you know, for all the crying and gnashing of teeth, we were not taking away from our care of our veterans or our disabilities. But we were able to take those 30,000. I did all of that, taking out 30,000 people, which is bigger than most departments in government, and we got everything I just told you. The disability claims went down, the wait times got better because we started acting more efficiently and knowing that numbers count and that our veterans depended on us. So yeah, that's really some good stuff.
Yeah, quick results. It's amazing what happens when you change culture, as you just talked about being.
And we're still working on it. Believe me, I've said, you know, we made a lot of easy changes here in the first 9 months. I call it easy. Some of them don't. Now we're getting into some more reorganization within VHA. We're looking at making it more streamlined so our hospitals can get, you know, what they need. you know, we're getting pushback. We've never done it that way before. Thank God I pastored a Baptist church for 11 years. I know what that means, you know. And I say, well, you're going to be fine. We'll move on. And so you just push them through.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one thing we talk about a lot at Veterans on Duty, we've discussed the military recruitment issues that we've had in the past. And there's a really interesting connection between people who are saying, we're not sure about joining the military because they know, well, when I get out, will I be taken care of by the VA? And so even though that, you know, many people look at that as a, you know, Department of War issue, it also does come back to Veterans Affairs a lot of times of, hey, look, if you serve your country, if you volunteer to serve, we will take care of you. You know, and if you give the ultimate sacrifice, we'll take care of the widow or children. I mean, so that how do you see that connection here playing out?
It was great. It started way before. You know, a lot of people, and I need to clarify this by saying, you know, President Trump has taken a lot of hits for his cabinet, and I'm part of that. You know, these are, you know, they wasn't prepared for this. They have no, you know, I will say, yeah, you look across his cabinet, we were not groomed to be cabinet members. I was not raised in an Ivy League school or went to the, you know, in Marco Rubio. And, you know, you look at all those, Pete, Pam, Brooke, Lee. We're sort of fighters. We just sort of, and I don't mean that in a pugilistic sense, but I mean, we came up in work and business together. Most of us have worked together in some way. We either served together or we've worked together. So we have a great relationship. I pick up the phone and can call any of them. In fact, I just had breakfast with Lee Zeldin this morning. He came over. But so what does that mean? What does it mean for us? And what does it mean as we look at putting it together? It means that the veteran in the transition time out of the military, getting this in, and the benefits that we have, I'm dependent sometimes on other places, Department of War being one. Our friend Secretary of War, Pete, and I talked before we ever got sworn in. I said, I came up to him one night and I said, Pete, I want to have your help on something. He said, what do you need? I said, you got to help me fix the defense health folks. I said, because if they're having bad experiences with your folks, they're never going to trust my folks. And I said, so we got to fix this. And he had never thought of it that way. And I said, it's a retention recruitment issue. Now, we're doing retention recruitment pretty good right now, but it's still a long-term problem as you look at it, to make sure that on both ends that we're taking it. So we got to remember that, and this is where I think it's helped us with have a great relationship. I've been to the Pentagon. He's been over here. By the way, the first time that had ever happened, that these two cabinet secretaries had never gotten together, and yet I say we're fraternal.
We never
got together in formal ways of that. But I've always said we're fraternal twins. We just do different things with the veterans at different times in their life.
That's right.
And you know, Pete gets them in and uses them, and then sends them to me, and then we all the way to burial. So we need to be coordinated. And so he got that, and transition became one of those issues. Recruitment, you know, how you get out, how people get out, and what they experience right after they get out. All we're back to the number I saw, which was very disturbing to me, that 40 to 50% of current military members were telling their children not to go in. I think Pete addressed that the other day at his speech. We got to think of it differently. The other thing is this transition issue. And Pete owns it. I get blamed for it. And I've told him this all along. I said, if I'm going to get blamed for it, I'm going to have some equity in this. So we're working it right now to say, how can we move something that's really not truly a part of the Department of War, because it's in that last phase of transition getting out, but then making it easier to come to us, which leaves a warm handoff, if you would. So those are the ways we're working at it to give a complete experience to a person coming through so that they can look back and say, yeah, go in, because it's worth it.
Absolutely. As we're starting to close here, one question I wanted to talk about, just obviously a major issue, is the veteran mental health crisis. I mean, the numbers of veterans who are committing suicide, I've seen some numbers say above 20 veterans a day committing suicide. It's horrific. And I think it's interesting that you, being a chaplain, both of us as men of faith, how do you see the intersection between faith and helping people? What is your message to veterans who might be struggling?
One, you're not alone. I think that's the one thing. 60% of all veterans who have death by suicide have not been touched by VA. Don't you just take that in for a second. 60%, at least, of what we can number now are not being touched by the VA. And I was sitting with a gentleman just the other day up in Boston, and he is going through some treatment program. And he said, and I asked him, I said, was you part of the VA? Because he had wanted to take his own life, and he went to the hospital, and they helped him. I mean, he got help, which is perfect. I said, did you ever think about going to, did you join the VA? He said, no. He said, I was never that bad. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, I always thought it was for somebody else. So there's this idea out there that you have to be a paraplegic, you have to have, you know, a gunshot wound, you had to have been injured for the VA. The VA is for everyone. The VA is for every veteran who served. And it, now, you may not get, you know, there may be some copay, there may be some limitations on what, you know, your care, or you may get 100% care depending on your disability rating. It's all there, but it's there for you. And I would encourage veterans as they get out, to start that, whether you use the VA for everything or not, it gives you something as you progress up in life that you'll always, you know, have. But I think from mental health perspective as a chaplain, I go to every one of our chaplain offices and every one of our hospitals. I make sure they're integrated. I make sure they're staffed because I want them to have that spiritual component along with the physical and mental well-being piece that needs to be there, and our chaplains need to be for that. We're doing a whole process now on retraining our folks on how to deal with those who may be contemplating death, who are dealing with mental health issues. We've lowered our times for emergency to get them into something to the day of. We're getting people as they come in. We make an assessment that they need help now. We're getting them into places and making emergency decisions. And even if it's a non-emergency, within, you know, 24 to 48 hours, we're getting people placed. This is a commitment that we have. But it's also a commitment to say that please don't feel alone. If you're listening to this podcast, you see anything we do, and for veterans out there, I sort of turn this because the person who may be thinking about harming themselves is not listening to me right now. Because I, as someone who's counseled with those, I've had it described one time by somebody who was in that position. They said it's like a light in your light just keeps getting smaller and smaller, and that's all you see. And so what I really say is, veterans out there, have you forgot your battle buddies? Have you forgot your wingman? Have you forgot, you know, the people that you go with? And if you're thinking about somebody right now that you used to didn't know, and it maybe not have been in your unit, maybe it's just down the street or over, and you hadn't heard from them in a while, maybe this is your call to text them, pick up the phone and say, hey, how you doing? You'd be amazed at how many calls I hear about that people said I was about to end it all, and somebody called me. So everybody's got a part in this. Once you raise your hand, you never lower it. Once you say I'm in, you're always in. And you got to remember that.
That's exactly right. Our last question at the end, we always have a time where we talk about a challenge coin that means something to you. And I know you brought one, so I wanted to hear the story.
I brought one. I am honored beyond belief to be Secretary of VA. And I get coins all the time. And I have my own coin that I made special and put my name on. I signed it, but on the back, I flipped it over. I moved the veteran seal down, and I put my Air Force colonel and the Air Force on the back. So it's special to me. But the ones that are very special to me are the people that we get to take care of. And especially when they are true heroes. And a gentleman that I got to know, and you may have known the story, is in or Afghanistan, Jake Tapper wrote the book about. Outpost is the movie. And if you remember the movie, they were down in the valley and they were constantly under attack. And then they finally tried to overrun them. One of the gentlemen in that movie, in fact, Scott Eastwood played this gentleman. His name was Clint Ramesh. His name is Ro. Everybody knows him as Ro. I got to know him. He came in. He earned, you know, he was honored with the Medal of Honor. He's a recipient of the Medal of Honor. One of the most humble people you will ever meet. And he came to see me, and we were talking, and we've gotten to know each other. We talked, and we're hopefully, you know, going to get up, maybe go pheasant hunting one day and get to that. But he turned to hand me, at the end, I gave him one of my coins, and he gave me his. His coin, he makes himself. He said it's almost like a therapy. For, you know, he enjoys doing it. If you notice here, that's his Medal of Honor.
Wow.
The 8 is how many they lost. And on the back is his infantry and Clint Ro Ramesh.
Amazing.
Made it himself. I have a, next to my desk, I separate from all of the hundreds of other coins that I have displayed. I have a small display like this that only are Medal of Honors.
That's cool.
And this one sits right in. So you asked about one that means a lot to me. This one means a lot to me. and what he means and how he carries himself. And if you meet Medal of Honor recipients, they're almost to a T, that's who they are. Extraordinary people who did extraordinary things and never intended to do extraordinary things.
Absolutely.
And they struggle with it sometimes.
Yeah. Well, but
Roe is a dear friend.
That is remarkable. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for your time today and sharing even from your early days all the way to now. It's been such a great time getting to know you, your story, and also everything that you're doing to help veterans. And we want to give you our coin. It is not as special as a Medal of Honor coin, but our Veterans on Duty coin of Beyond the Caller series here. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I appreciate it. Thanks. I enjoyed it.
Here at Veterans on Duty, we are a policy advocacy organization focused on making sure our military is strong, lethal, and focused. All of that, of course, is about making sure America is safe, strong, and free. Those are the values that we hold dear, Vets on Duty, and that's why we're gonna be sitting down with different leaders, veterans, policymakers, even some elected officials in our Beyond the Call video series. Stay tuned and join us.